Abraham, Moses, and Jesus are the first three key prophets. And then, of course, Muhammad is the last prophet. So there is a high level of respect for those three prophets and the teachings of those three prophets. Most Muslims will actually read the Torah. They will read the red letters in the New Testament. They hold these in high respect. So if you're witnessing to Muslims, there's your in. There are certain passages in John they would have a great deal of trouble with, and doctrinally. But okay. Five pillars of Islam. These are key things every Muslim is to practice. And all Muslims that are relatively orthodox will agree with these five. The first is Allah is one and Muhammad is his final prophet. The direct English translation of the official phrase, this is as close to a transliteration as I could find, I bear witness that there is no God but Allah, and I bear witness that Muhammad is his messenger. In context, that means Muhammad is the final messenger. No one gets to add onto Muhammad in traditional Islam and to have the same level of authority. You can have teachers who can help explain Muhammad, but Muhammad is the final say. Next, we have prayers. This one most of you are familiar with. You are supposed to pray five times daily facing toward Mecca. So, wherever you are in the world, you're facing towards Mecca. On Fridays at noon, unofficially you're supposed to be in a mosque doing it. So the noon prayers. So, for example, I teach at UT. I have a lot of Islamic students. When I'm teaching a Monday, Wednesday, Friday class in the afternoon, I don't have any Muslim students, because they can't be there. The prayers must be said in Arabic. Every good Muslim will learn Arabic. There are a number of reasons for that we'll get into in a moment. Next, purifying tax. This is a 2.5% tax of a person's wealth, not income. Wealth, all your possessions, every year, 2.5%. So this is like an inheritance tax while you're still alive. And this 2.5% purifying tax is to go to the poor. Usually that is arranged through your local mosque. Additional charity beyond the 2.5% is also encouraged, but it's not required. Fasting. This is particularly the holy month of Ramadan. During Ramadan, if you're a practicing Muslim, you are not supposed to eat or drink before dawn and dusk. Now, Islam is on a lunar calendar, so Ramadan will sometimes be during the summer. Much more difficult to practice this during the summer than during the winter. Because A, the days are longer, and B, it's much less pleasant. Yes? No eating between dawn and dusk. No eating or drinking during daylight hours. Fasting is a purification ritual. The idea is to cleanse yourself and become right with Allah. That is the goal, the objective of the fasting. There are exemptions to Ramadan. If you are elderly, sick, pregnant, etc., you do not have to practice Ramadan. You are, however, supposed to practice it later in the year when you are physically able to do so. And our final one, pilgrimage to Mecca for those who are able. And with the advent of airplanes, far more Muslims are able to make the pilgrimage than known as the Hajj than in the past. You're supposed to go at least once during your lifetime, and you are supposed to go to Mecca, go through the rituals of the annual Hajj. This is takes place at a certain time. I don't remember when it is, but there's an annual. Basically, all the airlines who fly into Saudi Arabia triple their flights at this time because there's such demand. All right, the holy works of Islam. First, the Quran. We talked a little bit about this. This is a recitation supposedly from the angel Gabriel. By the way, I'll just mention this as a side note. The formation of the Quran is strikingly similar to the formation of the Book of Mormon. If you take a look at the history of the beginnings of these two religions, they are nearly identical, except for one is strictly monotheist and the other is polytheist. I have a feeling they're not both right. Technically, most Muslims will tell you the Quran should only be read in English, Arabic. A couple years ago, the University of North Carolina decided all their incoming freshmen needed to read these excerpts from the Quran. This created an uproar among the Christians because they're making them read the Quran, and it created an uproar among the Muslims because it was in English. Not supposed to do that. Part of the miracle of the Quran is that it is in Arabic. It is a very weird book to read in English. It's very disjointed. It's almost nonsensical at times. But if you just listen to it being recited in Arabic, there's definitely a poetic, rhythmic flow to it. That is part of it. That is part of the experience, they will tell you. So you're not doing it right unless it's in Arabic. Let's see here. And another thing they point to along with this is Muhammad, they'll tell you, was either illiterate or nearly illiterate. So the fact that he was able to recite these beautiful poetic things was a miracle and proof that it came from God. The Quran is the official holy book. Nothing is allowed to go against the Quran. These next two, the Hadith and the Sunnah, are more suggestive, not necessarily required. The Hadith is the teachings of Muhammad that are not in the Quran, so like a collection of his sermons. This is where you get the kill the infidels. That's in Hadith. The Hadith is only authoritative to the extent that it is correct, because the official Islamic position, needless to say, there's a lot of division over what parts are correct. That is the big fight that leads to most of the sectarianism within Islam. What portions of the Hadith do we take seriously? The Sunnah, similar to the Hadith, is the record of the actions of Islam, of Muhammad and later leaders. So the Sunnah is recording the actions. The Sunnah is taken much more seriously by the Sunnis than other groups. Sunnis get their name from the Sunnah. Okay, pause for questions. Yes.
You said that part of the experience of reading the Quran is the rhythmic flow.
Yes.
That there is in the Arabic. If it's nonsensical in some ways or doesn't make sense, let's put it that way, in some places in English, why does that not come over in Arabic? Even though it doesn't,
well, a former Muslim told me it doesn't make much sense in Arabic either.
Oh. I thought maybe there was
It's a very difficult book.
Okay.
It makes Revelations look simple. Yeah.
Would that be similar to having a the writings of Nostradamus as your primary? I mean, is it that obscure?
It's less obscure than Nostradamus, I would say. I mean, Nostradamus was intentionally obscure so he could look brilliant. There are some clearly stated things in the Quran. Most of them are not, and the organization is just very, very odd. But there are some clearer things. And it's on those clearer things that every Muslim will agree. The five pillars, all clear. Everyone will agree on those. There was an interesting story about how they end up with five prayers a day, because apparently Allah originally ordered 50, and Moses convinced Muhammad to negotiate down. I remember that one from reading the Quran.
Is there any kind of textual variant criticism that we see?
Not really. Muslims were very good at... I mean, they made the monks look bad as far as copying. They were very, very serious about every jot and tittle, to use Jesus' terminology. They were very careful about direct copying. There are a couple of controversies. I haven't studied them enough to know what to make of them, but it's very unusual. It's really been kept textually very, very close. And part of the ability to do that is it's all in the same language since the beginning. So you don't have any translations. All right, any other questions?
We hear about at least, I'm just grabbing the little bits and pieces that I hear, I guess, about like president of Iran waiting for the final prophet to
come. We will get there.
Okay.
Yes, that is coming.
I wonder, which book is that in?
That's more oral tradition. I'll put that way for now. It's more oral tradition. Okay. Let's see. Sects in Islam. First, by far the biggest group are the Sunnis. They have approximately 85% of Muslims are Sunni. The Sunni focus is on following the example of Muhammad. The term Sunnah is the examples. So a Sunni is one who seeks to follow the examples of Muhammad and some early successors of Muhammad. It's by far the largest sect. They are followers of the Sunnah much more than the other groups. And Islamic law is called Sharia. You've probably heard that term. Sunnis are very methodical in their interpretation of Sharia. Every major Sunni group has a particular methodology they use in the interpretation. This is very helpful to them in organizing the very disorganized Quran. So the Sunnis are, for example, much more likely to be systematic theologians than other groups. And that has had some major influences on Christianity we'll talk about in a few minutes. Next we have the Shia. This is the second or third largest sect, depending on how you measure things. They are mostly in Iran and Iraq. In Iran are the Persian Shia, and in Iraq are the Arab Shia. We hear a lot about them on the news. The focus of the Shia isn't on the actions of Muhammad, but on the words of Muhammad. The focus is on what did he teach. So the Shia are much more likely to focus on the Hadith, whereas the Sunnis are much more likely to focus on the Sunnah. There's also a focus in Shia on proper succession. According to Shia, the real successors of Muhammad are the relatives of Muhammad. Muhammad didn't have any sons, so a true successor to Muhammad must be related to Muhammad's favorite daughter. So Shia, at the very beginning, in 632 after Muhammad died, believed that the successor ought to be Muhammad's son-in-law, Ali. Another familiar name. And Ali was denied leadership because the Sunnis, they weren't called Shia and Sunni at the time, but the Sunnis said, no, they ought to be picked by the elders in council, and we just pick the person who we think will do the best job of especially interpreting the texts. So again, a methodological focus with the Sunnis right at the beginning, with Shia right at the beginning, a focus on leadership structure. The rulers who were descended from Muhammad's daughter were known as imams. You've heard this term, too. There were, according to Shia, 11 imams. No, I take that back. There were actually 12 imams. The 12th one, according to most Shia, not all Shia, most Shia, the 12th imam did not die. He was about to be executed by the other sect, those nasty Sunnis. So God took him into hiding, and he is still in hiding to this day. And when God returns in judgment, the 12th imam will reappear and rule the earthly realm. This is semi-messianic. As a result of these, Shia who hold this are called Twelvers. That's not derogatory, that's what they call themselves, Twelvers. And there tends to be a focus among the Twelvers, much more than there are among the Sunnis, that it is a responsibility of Islam to prepare the world for the Second Coming. Not the Second Coming, the Return. They wouldn't call it Second Coming. The Return. So the steps taken to prepare the world for the Return are very dramatically, but you can use your imagination and see where some of this can go theologically. Let me talk briefly about the relationship between Sunnis and Shia. They obviously disagree about some fairly major things. Most of history, however, they peacefully coexisted. The exceptions would be the 7th century, the 13th century, and the 20th century into the 21st century. Most of the time, these two groups got along with each other, at least were agreed to disagree. This resurgence of... I spoke with some Iraqis who are in the U.S. now, and they were all sort of surprised that the Shia and Sunnis are now fighting each other because, as one of them said, two of my aunts are Sunni. I'm Shia. Oh my. So these split families in Iraq right now are having a lot of trouble, and there are a lot of split families in Iraq. A lot of them just automatically just flee to Jordan because that way they don't have to worry about it. Okay, so next, Sufis. These are the ones you're most likely to learn about in elementary school. These are the mystics. They can be Sunni or Shia. They're not too concerned about the theological differences. The focus is on relationship with God. Most Sufis are pantheistic or panentheistic. A pantheist is someone who believes everything is God. A panentheist is someone who believes everything is in God. So you can still be a monotheist pantheist, technically, which is what most Sufis would claim to adhere to. The focus of the Sufis is experiential relationship. You experience God. You go through rituals to experience God. The worship of Sufis is far, far more artistic than other Islamic groups. Poetry is a key component of Sufi worship. If you're familiar with the whirling dervishes, that's Sufi. That is, the idea is to get yourself in an ecstatic state so that you are in closer relationship with Allah. The Sufis are largely Neoplatonic. So if you remember the first time I taught in here, I talked a little bit about this guy named Plotinus. To this day, the Sufis still read and adhere to Plotinus. So the idea is everything that was created was emanated from God. So God created everything, and it was an emanation, but everything is still connected. It fits in very well with overall Sufi theology. Unlike other branches of Islam, Sufism feels comfortable saying God has emotions. The other branches of Islam will not say that, even though there are passages in the Quran that would indicate he would. But other branches do not say something like that. Sufism will say that, will attribute God with emotions. Yes?
Why would they say or believe that God does not have emotion?
That is a philosophical argument derived. You can actually get there from Neoplatonism and Aristotle. So if you try to do a logical progression, you end up with a God that has no feelings, or at the very least, if he has feelings, are not feelings you can express.
That he can express?
No, that we can understand, I'll put it that way, that we could understand, so you're better off just not saying anything about it. Okay, Wahhabi. They actually prefer Muwaddun. However, I've never heard anyone in the West refer to them this way, so we'll go with Wahhabi. These are followers of a teacher, Wahhabi. This is very new. This started 19th century. Why am I telling you about them? Because they are very important geopolitically now. In the 1920s, followers of Wahhabi took over the Arabian Peninsula, the Saud family, Saudi Arabia. What cities are in Saudi Arabia? Mecca and Medina. Whenever Muslims go on Hajj, travel to Mecca, they are inundated with Wahhabi teaching. That is the official religion of the Saudi state. They don't force everyone to be Wahhabi. Most Saudis are Sunni, but and Wahhabism is sort of a breakoff of Sunnism. Some key teachings of Wahhabi. Much more focus on Muhammad himself. So the things that came after Muhammad, you reject, they've been corrupted, you go back to the original teachings of Muhammad. The goal is to return Islam to the purity of its beginnings. There is a sixth pillar to Islam. This will cause a whole bunch of things to connect for you. So there are the five pillars everyone agrees on. Wahhabi adds a sixth, and that is jihad. Jihad means struggle. That is the closest transliteration into English. So you have internal struggle and external struggle. The internal struggle is your struggle against sin and trying to become the best servant of Allah you can be. The external struggle is those outside of you who are making things difficult for you to be a true servant of Allah, such as Western society. Or, 20 years ago, communism. A famous, probably the most famous right now, member or adherent to Wahhabism is a guy named Osama bin Laden. His focus is much more on the external aspect of jihad than the internal aspect of jihad. Al-Qaeda technically is Wahhabi. So you have a lot of people who work with Al-Qaeda and they'll say, I am not Al-Qaeda. They're being honest. They are not Al-Qaeda. They belong to other religious sects. But Al-Qaeda is the organizing belief system behind, I'm sorry, Wahhabi is the organizing belief system behind Al-Qaeda. Okay, this last one. Most of you have probably never heard of it. It's not talked about a lot, but they could be very important geopolitically in the next 20 years. This is, Ahmadiyya. Most Muslims will say these people are not actual Muslims. If you do count this group as Muslim, they are probably the second largest sect in the world. There are probably more adherents of this than there are of Shia. They're found largely on the Indian subcontinent. The most dense population of this group is in the region of Kashmir. So all these wars between India and Pakistan are over this group of people. The Kashmiris themselves would rather just be independent because they would be persecuted by Pakistan, and India's dominant religion isn't Islam. So they actually prefer independence, but right now India and Pakistan fight with each other over them. The founder, I didn't write down his name, but the founder claimed to be someone who fulfilled both Islamic and Christian prophecy. It is an attempt to make Christian Islam. You might have heard the story about how Jesus actually survived the crucifixion, lived to be 120, and moved to India. That's these guys. He apparently is still buried in Kashmir, along with Mary Magdalene and their two children. As I said, most Muslims reject this as being Islam, because they reject it's not as pure monotheistically as they would like. And this guy claims to be a further prophet, which is a violation of point number two in Islam, which is Muhammad is the prophet. So this is a very large group. If India and Pakistan come to an agreement, this will be a very important group because they will have a significant population in one of two countries with nuclear weapons that are less timid about using them than some other countries might be. So keep an eye out for this group, and as evidence that you should listen to me, 16 years ago I gave a lecture on this telling people to pay attention to Wahhabi. So I have a track record. All right, questions?
Can you who founded this? Ahmadiyya?
I don't remember the individual's name.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
I just missed it.
Don't remember the individual's name. You can look it up. I believe I have the spelling there for you.
Wow.
Okay, so you can Google that. Oh, wait, you can't, but you can have someone else Google it for you.
I can Google.
Is salvation under all of these sects all a salvation of works? Is that always consistent with all of them? Or?
Yes. But there must at least be a works component. There is a faith component, but if you do not do the works, you obviously do not have the faith, and the works are much more regimented than, say, standard Christianity would be. You must do the five colors.
Is there any sense of sinfulness? I guess that's the heart of this, is that right? I mean, to a true Muslim, I mean, he looks upon himself as not meriting Allah's...
Right. No, there's a very strong sense of sin in Islam. And the method of forgiveness is not clear. It's more like, yeah, God will let you in anyway, in spite of, if you do enough good things.
So, it's like a scale. Good,
It is very much a scale. One prominent Muslim caliph from the early days, that's a leader, did actually describe it as a scale. Yes.
It was kind of just a comment, but my nephew, who was in Iraq, and he was in Mosul for most of the time, and then in Baghdad for 3 months, said this from a political standpoint. He said the Sunnis were really with it; they had control over the north, and that in Baghdad it was just chaos. They should let them control the whole thing.
That won't happen because the northern Sunnis you were speaking of were Kurdish Sunnis and not real popular among the other groups. Whole new story. I don't have time to get into this morning.
Did the Ahmadiyya assassinate that reporter, journalist in Pakistan?
It wouldn't surprise me, but I'm not sure.
The Taliban, which sect did they fall into?
Taliban. I think the Taliban are Shia. But I think they were a Shia minority in Afghanistan. I remember they were a minority group within Afghanistan, and they took over militaristically. I'm pretty sure they were Shia, but I don't remember real clearly right now. Okay. Islamic impacts on Christianity. These are going to be real quick. Militaristic. I'm going to let our military history people, Max, later Jackson. Max did cover a lot of this last week, and I'm thankful because I don't have to do the Battle of Tours now. But basically, the Christian West had to organize militaristically as a response to Islam. Because if they were not coordinated, they would have been overtaken fairly easily because Islam was very coordinated. Geographic. We'll talk about this more later in future weeks. Islam took over most of the Eastern Church. They allowed people to still practice Christianity. To this day, the Archbishop of Constantinople, which is now called Istanbul, but Christians still call it Constantinople, is allowed to practice and stay there. If you don't mess with them, they will generally leave you alone. You just won't have the same level of rights. This is not universal, but historically, taking the broad picture, most of the time this was the case. If you speak with a Muslim and point out, hey, you're a militaristic religion, they will instantly respond, when we took over Spain, we let the Christians stay Christians. When the Christians reconquered Spain, you killed us or kicked us out. Be prepared for that. Every Muslim will respond with that when you mention the militaristic aspect of their faith.
How do you counter that?
How do you counter that? We made mistakes. We made mistakes. The Christians messed up. You study enough church history, you don't have a beautiful view of the church in history. The Christian church made a lot of mistakes over the centuries. Okay, this last one, more my area. I'm a history thought person. Scholarly impacts on Christianity. First, scientific advances. The Muslim world made Europe look really, really bad for many centuries. Most scientific advances that were made between 600 and 1200 were made in the Islamic world. Christians were useless scientifically. And in fact, the advances we started making in the 13th century were because we started picking up stuff from them. Our mathematical system is theirs. We used to use Roman numerals. Try doing advanced mathematics using Roman numerals. They really did have significant advances scientifically. Philosophical preservation. You might remember when the Vandals, Huns, Visigoths came in, they burned a lot of the libraries. The libraries that remained were in the Eastern Christianity. And when the Muslims took over, instead of burning the libraries, what they did was they started copying everything down. They rediscovered Aristotle. Aristotle was forgotten for five centuries. No, seven centuries. Maybe six. We'll go with six centuries. They rediscovered Aristotle and really built a lot of their theological foundation around Aristotle. They sort of made Aristotle a monotheist and then said, okay, we've made him a monotheist even though he wasn't. Let's see what else we can get. Which leads to our theological influences. In a few weeks, or quite a few weeks, we'll be talking about scholasticism. Scholasticism is largely borrowed from Islam. The methodology scholastics use, and that is a big focus in scholasticism, are borrowed from Sunni methodology. Actually, taken straight out of Sunni methodology. Most of the Christianization of Aristotle was taken straight out of the Islamization of Aristotle. If you study Islamic philosophy, you don't find that much new in Aquinas. Most of it had been said already. Now, what is the influence of scholasticism in the Christian church? That became the official position of the Roman Catholic Church. That was the official philosophy, and it still to this day is the official philosophy. So in many respects, the official philosophy of the Roman Church is from Islam. Okay, that's all I have, I think. Yes. So, questions? Max?
Jerusalem, third holiest site. What is the...
Yeah, Jerusalem is the third holiest site. In the very, very early years, Jerusalem was the first holiest site. Then it got demoted to the third. First is Mecca, second is Medina. And then if you're Shia, you have another list.
Why is Jerusalem?
Why is Jerusalem? Respect for Jesus and Abraham and Moses. What?
The rock of the...
No. Predates that.
Okay.
Yeah, they built that later, after it was already established as a holy city. Now, it was a holy city starting year one.
I know it's a little off the subject, but what is the rock? Is
that a... Dome of the Rock, that's a Muslim... Yeah, it's built in the ground of the temple.
I know, but what is the rock? Dome of the Rock.
Dome of the Rock. The temple was built on a hill. That's it.
Oh, that's the rock. Oh, okay. Was something different. Okay.
Any final questions? We covered a whole lot today. Okay, let's close with a word of prayer. Dear Heavenly Father, thank you that we can call you Father and you have sent your Son to form a personal relationship with us. Thank you for giving us an opportunity to study these historical developments so that we can learn from history, not make the same mistakes, and also learn what we did right. Help us understand these things that we talked about today in our witnessing to Muslims. Be with us in service today. Thank you for all that you've done for us. In your name we pray. Amen. Abraham, Moses, and Jesus are the first three key prophets. And then, of course, Muhammad is the last prophet. So there is a high level of respect for those three prophets and the teachings of those three prophets. Most Muslims will actually read the Torah. They will read the red letters in the New Testament. They hold these in high respect. So if you're witnessing to Muslims, there's your in. There are certain passages in John they would have a great deal of trouble with, and doctrinally. But okay. Five pillars of Islam. These are key things every Muslim is to practice. And all Muslims that are relatively orthodox will agree with these five. The first is Allah is one and Muhammad is his final prophet. The direct English translation of the official phrase, this is as close to a transliteration as I could find, I bear witness that there is no God but Allah, and I bear witness that Muhammad is his messenger. In context, that means Muhammad is the final messenger. No one gets to add onto Muhammad in traditional Islam and to have the same level of authority. You can have teachers who can help explain Muhammad, but Muhammad is the final say. Next, we have prayers. This one most of you are familiar with. You are supposed to pray five times daily facing toward Mecca. So, wherever you are in the world, you're facing towards Mecca. On Fridays at noon, unofficially you're supposed to be in a mosque doing it. So the noon prayers. So, for example, I teach at UT. I have a lot of Islamic students. When I'm teaching a Monday, Wednesday, Friday class in the afternoon, I don't have any Muslim students because they can't be there. The prayers must be said in Arabic. Every good Muslim will learn Arabic. There are a number of reasons for that we'll get into in a moment. Next, purifying tax. This is a 2.5% tax of a person's wealth, not income. Wealth, all your possessions, every year, 2.5%. So this is like an inheritance tax while you're still alive. And this 2.5% purifying tax is to go to the poor. Usually that is arranged through your local mosque. Additional charity beyond the 2.5% is also encouraged, but it's not required. Fasting. This is particularly the holy month of Ramadan. During Ramadan, if you're practicing Muslim, you are not supposed to eat or drink before dawn and dusk. Now, Islam is on a lunar calendar, so Ramadan will sometimes be during the summer. Much more difficult to practice this during the summer than during the winter. Because A, the days are longer, and B, it's much less pleasant. Yes? No eating between dawn and dusk. No eating or drinking during daylight hours. Fasting is a purification ritual. The idea is to cleanse yourself and become right with Allah. That is the goal, the objective of the fasting. There are exemptions to Ramadan. If you are elderly, sick, pregnant, etc., you do not have to practice Ramadan. You are, however, supposed to practice it later in the year when you are physically able to do so. And our final one, pilgrimage to Mecca for those who are able. And with the advent of airplanes, far more Muslims are able to make the pilgrimage than known as the Hajj than in the past. You're supposed to go at least once during your lifetime, and you are supposed to go to Mecca, go through the rituals of the annual Hajj. This is takes place at a certain time. I don't remember when it is, but there's an annual. Basically, all the airlines who fly into Saudi Arabia triple their flights at this time because there's such demand. All right, the holy works of Islam. First, the Quran. We talked a little bit about this. This is a recitation supposedly from the angel Gabriel. By the way, I'll just mention this as a side note. The formation of the Quran is strikingly similar to the formation of the Book of Mormon. If you take a look at the history of the beginnings of these two religions, they are nearly identical, except for one is strictly monotheist and the other is polytheist. I have a feeling they're not both right. Technically, most Muslims will tell you the Quran should only be read in English, Arabic. A couple years ago, the University of North Carolina decided all their incoming freshmen needed to read these excerpts from the Quran. This created an uproar among the Christians because they're making them read the Quran, and it created an uproar among the Muslims because it was in English. Not supposed to do that. Part of the miracle of the Quran is that it is in Arabic. It is a very weird book to read in English. It's very disjointed. It's almost nonsensical at times. But if you just listen to it being recited in Arabic, there's definitely a poetic, rhythmic flow to it. That is part of it. That is part of the experience, they will tell you. So you're not doing it right unless it's in Arabic. Let's see here. And another thing they point to along with this is Muhammad, they'll tell you, was either illiterate or nearly illiterate. So the fact that he was able to recite these beautiful poetic things was a miracle and proof that it came from God. The Quran is the official holy book. Nothing is allowed to go against the Quran. These next two, the Hadith and the Sunnah, are more suggestive, not necessarily required. The Hadith is the teachings of Muhammad that are not in the Quran, so like a collection of his sermons. This is where you get the kill the infidels. That's in Hadith. The Hadith is only authoritative to the extent that it is correct. Because the official Islamic position, needless to say, there's a lot of division over what parts are correct. That is the big fight that leads to most of the sectarianism within Islam. What portions of the Hadith do we take seriously? The Sunnah, similar to the Hadith, is the record of the actions of Islam, of Muhammad and later leaders. So the Sunnah is recording the actions. The Sunnah is taken much more seriously by the Sunnis than other groups. Sunnis get their name from the Sunnah. Okay, pause for questions. Yes.
You said that part of the experience of reading the Quran is the rhythmic flow.
Yes.
That there is in the Arabic. If it's nonsensical in some ways or doesn't make sense, let's put it that way, in some places in English, why does that not come over in Arabic? Even though it doesn't
well, it, 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 it,
I mean,
A former Muslim told me it doesn't make much sense in Arabic either. It's a very difficult book. It's a very difficult book. It makes Revelations look simple.
Would that be similar to having a the writings of Nostradamus as your primary? I mean, is it that obscure?
It's less obscure than Nostradamus, I would say. I mean, Nostradamus was intentionally obscure so he could look brilliant. There are some clearly stated things in the Quran. Most of them are not, and the organization is just very, very odd. But there are some clearer things. And it's on those clearer things that every Muslim will agree. The five pillars, all clear. Everyone will agree on those. There was an interesting story about how they end up with five prayers a day, because apparently Allah originally ordered 50, and Moses convinced Muhammad to negotiate down. I remember that one from reading the Quran.
Is there any kind of textual variant criticism that we see?
Not really. Muslims were very good at, I mean, they made the monks look bad as far as copying. They were very, very serious about every jot and tittle, to use Jesus' terminology. They were very careful about direct copying. There are a couple of controversies. I haven't studied them enough to know what to make of them, but it's very unusual. It's really been kept textually very, very close. And part of the ability to do that is it's all in the same language since the beginning. So you don't have any translations. All right, any other questions?
We hear about at least, I'm just grabbing a little bits and pieces that I hear, about like president of Iran waiting for the final prophet.
We will get there.
Okay.
Yes, that is coming.
I wonder which book is that in?
That's more oral tradition. I'll put that way for now. It's more oral tradition. Okay. Let's see. Sects in Islam. First, by far the biggest group are the Sunnis. They have approximately 85% of Muslims are Sunni. The Sunni focus is on following the example of Muhammad. The term Sunnah is the examples. So a Sunni is one who seeks to follow the examples of Muhammad and some early successors of Muhammad. It's by far the largest sect. They are followers of the Sunnah much more than the other groups. And Islamic law is called Sharia. You've probably heard that term. Sunnis are very methodical in their interpretation of Sharia. Every major Sunni group has a particular methodology they use in the interpretation. This is very helpful to them in organizing the very disorganized Quran. So the Sunnis are, for example, much more likely to be systematic theologians than other groups. And that has had some major influences on Christianity we'll talk about in a few minutes. Next we have the Shia. This is the second or third largest sect, depending on how you measure things. They are mostly in Iran and Iraq. In Iran are the Persian Shia, and in Iraq are the Arab Shia. We hear a lot about them on the news. The focus of the Shia isn't on the actions of Muhammad, but on the words of Muhammad. The focus is on what did he teach. So the Shia are much more likely to focus on the Hadith, whereas the Sunnis are much more likely to focus on the Sunnah. There's also a focus in Shia on proper succession. According to Shia, the real successors of Muhammad are the relatives of Muhammad. Muhammad didn't have any sons, so a true successor to Muhammad must be related to Muhammad's favorite daughter. So Shia, at the very beginning, in 632 after Muhammad died, believed that the successor ought to be Muhammad's son-in-law, Ali. Another familiar name. And Ali was denied leadership because the Sunnis, they weren't called Shia and Sunni at the time, but the Sunnis said, no, they ought to be picked by the elders in council, and we just pick the person who we think will do the best job of especially interpreting the texts. So again, a methodological focus with the Sunnis right at the beginning, with Shia right at the beginning, a focus on leadership structure. The rulers who were descended from Muhammad's daughter were known as imams. You've heard this term, too. There were, according to Shia, 11 imams. No, I take that back. There were actually 12 imams. The 12th one, according to most Shia, not all Shia, most Shia, the 12th imam did not die. He was about to be executed by the other sect, those nasty Sunnis. So God took him into hiding, and he is still in hiding to this day. And when God returns in judgment, the 12th imam will reappear and rule the earthly realm. This is semi-messianic. As a result of these, Shia who hold this are called Twelvers. That's not derogatory, that's what they call themselves, Twelvers. And there tends to be a focus among the Twelvers, much more than there are among the Sunnis, that it is a responsibility of Islam to prepare the world for the Second Coming. Not the Second Coming, the Return. They wouldn't call it Second Coming, the Return. So the steps taken to prepare the world for the Return are very dramatically, but you can use your imagination and see where some of this can go theologically. Let me talk briefly about the relationship between Sunnis and Shia. They obviously disagree about some fairly major things. Most of history, however, they peacefully coexisted. The exceptions would be the 7th century, the 13th century, and the 20th century into the 21st century. Most of the time, these two groups got along with each other, at least were agreed to disagree. This resurgence of... I spoke with some Iraqis who are in the U.S. now, and they were all sort of surprised that the Shia and Sunnis are now fighting each other because, as one of them said, two of my aunts are Sunni. I'm Shia. Oh my. So these split families in Iraq right now are having a lot of trouble, and there are a lot of split families in Iraq. A lot of them just automatically just flee to Jordan because that way they don't have to worry about it. Okay, so next, Sufis. These are the ones you're most likely to learn about in elementary school. These are the mystics. They can be Sunni or Shia. They're not too concerned about the theological differences. The focus is on relationship with God. Most Sufis are pantheistic or panentheistic. A pantheist is someone who believes everything is God. A panentheist is someone who believes everything is in God. So you can still be a monotheist pantheist, technically, which is what most Sufis would claim to adhere to. The focus of the Sufis is experiential relationship. You experience God, you go through rituals to experience God. The worship of Sufis is far, far more artistic than other Islamic groups. Poetry is a key component of Sufi worship. If you're familiar with the whirling dervishes, that's Sufi. That is, the idea is to get yourself in an ecstatic state so that you are in closer relationship with Allah. The Sufis are largely Neoplatonic. So, if you remember the first time I taught in here, I talked a little bit about this guy named Plotinus. To this day, the Sufis still read and adhere to Plotinus. So the idea is everything that was created was emanated from God. So God created everything, and it was an emanation, but everything is still connected. It fits in very well with overall Sufi theology. Unlike other branches of Islam, Sufism feels comfortable saying God has emotions. The other branches of Islam will not say that, even though there are passages in the Quran that would indicate he would. But other branches do not say something like that. Sufism will say that, will attribute God with emotions. Yes?
Why would they say or believe that God does not have emotion?
That is a philosophical argument derived. You can actually get there from Neoplatonism and Aristotle. So if you try to do a logical progression, you end up with a God that has no feelings, or at the very least, if he has feelings, are not feelings you can express.
That he can express?
No, that we can understand, I'll put it that way, that we could understand, so you're better off just not saying anything about it. Okay, Wahhabi. They actually prefer Muwaddun. However, I've never heard anyone in the West refer to them this way, so we'll go with Wahhabi. These are followers of a teacher, Wahhabi. This is very new. This started 19th century. Why am I telling you about them? Because they are very important geopolitically now. In the 1920s, followers of Wahhabi took over the Arabian Peninsula. The Saud family. Saudi Arabia. What cities are in Saudi Arabia? Mecca and Medina. Whenever Muslims go on Hajj, travel to Mecca, they are inundated with Wahhabi teaching. That is the official religion of the Saudi states. They don't force everyone to be Wahhabi. Most Saudis are Sunni, but and Wahhabism is sort of a breakoff of Sunnism. Some key teachings of Wahhabi. Much more focus on Muhammad himself. So the things that came after Muhammad, you reject, they've been corrupted, you go back to the original teachings of Muhammad. The goal is to return Islam to the purity of its beginnings. There is a sixth pillar to Islam. This will cause a whole bunch of things to connect for you. So there are the five pillars everyone agrees on. Wahhabi adds a sixth, and that is jihad. Jihad means struggle. That is the closest transliteration into English. So you have internal struggle and external struggle. The internal struggle is your struggle against sin and trying to become the best servant of Allah you can be. The external struggle is those outside of you who are making things difficult for you to be a true servant of Allah, such as Western society. Or, 20 years ago, communism. A famous, probably the most famous right now, member or adherent to Wahhabism is a guy named Osama bin Laden. His focus is much more on the external aspect of jihad than the internal aspect of jihad. Al-Qaeda, technically, is Wahhabi. So you have a lot of people who work with Al-Qaeda and they'll say, I'm not Al-Qaeda. They're being honest. They are not Al-Qaeda. They belong to other religious sects. But Al-Qaeda is the organizing belief system behind, Wahhabi is the organizing belief system behind Al-Qaeda. Okay, this last one. Most of you have probably never heard of it. It's not talked about a lot, but they could be very important geopolitically in the next 20 years. This is, Ahmadiyya. Ahmadiyya. Most Muslims will say these people are not actual Muslims. If you do count this group as Muslim, they are probably the second largest sect in the world. There are probably more adherents of this than there are of Shia. They're found largely on the Indian subcontinent. The most dense population of this group is in the region of Kashmir. So all these wars between India and Pakistan are over this group of people. The Kashmiris themselves would rather just be independent because they would be persecuted by Pakistan, and India's dominant religion isn't Islam. So they actually prefer independence, but right now India and Pakistan fight with each other over it. The founder, I didn't write down his name, but the founder claimed to be someone who fulfilled both Islamic and Christian prophecy. It is an attempt to make Christian Islam. You might have heard the story about how Jesus actually survived the crucifixion, lived to be 120, and moved to India. That's these guys. He apparently is still buried in Kashmir, along with Mary Magdalene and their two children. As I said, most Muslims reject this as being Islam because they reject it's not as pure monotheistically as they would like. And this guy claims to be a further prophet, which is a violation of point number two in Islam, which is Muhammad is the prophet. So this is a very large group. India and Pakistan come to an agreement, this will be a very important group because they will have a significant population in one of two countries with nuclear weapons that are less timid about using them than some other countries might be. So keep an eye out for this group, and as evidence that you should listen to me, 16 years ago I gave a lecture on this telling people to pay attention to Wahhabi. So, I have a track record. All right, questions?
Who founded this? Ahmadiyya?
I don't remember the individual's name.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
I just missed it.
Don't remember the individual's name. You can look it up. I believe I have the spelling there for you. Okay, so you can Google that. Oh, wait, you can't, but you can have someone else Google it for you.
I can Google.
Is salvation under all of these sects all a salvation of works? Is that almost consistent with all of them? Or?
Yes. Well, there must at least be a works component. There is a faith component, but if you do not do the works, you obviously do not have the faith, and the works are much more regimented than say, standard Christianity, maybe. You must do the five pillars.
Is there any sense of sinfulness? I guess that's the heart of this, is that right? I mean, to a true Muslim, I mean, he looks upon himself as not meriting Allah's...
Right. No, there's a very strong sense of sin in Islam. and the method of forgiveness is not clear. It's more like, yeah, God will let you in anyway, in spite of, if you do enough good things. It is very much a scale. One prominent Muslim caliph from the early days, that's a leader, did actually describe it as a scale. Yes?
It was kind of just a comment, but my nephew who was in Iraq, and he was in Mosul for most of the time, and then in Baghdad for 3 months, said this. From a political standpoint, he said the Sunnis were really with it. They had control over the north, but in Baghdad it was just chaos.
He felt
like they should let them control the whole thing.
That won't happen because the northern Sunnis you were speaking of were Kurdish Sunnis, and not real popular among the other groups. Whole new story. Don't have time to get into this morning.
The Ahmadiyya assassinate that reporter, journalist in Pakistan?
It wouldn't surprise me, but I'm not sure.
The Taliban, which sect did they fall into?
Taliban. I think the Taliban are Shia. But I think they were a Shia minority in Afghanistan I remember they were a minority group within Afghanistan and they took over militaristically. I'm pretty sure they were Shia, but I don't remember real clearly right now. Okay. Islamic impacts on Christianity. These are going to be real quick. Militaristic. I'm going to let our military history people, Max, later Jackson. Max did cover a lot of this last week, and I'm thankful because I don't have to do the battle of tours now. But basically, the Christian West had to organize militaristically as a response to Islam. Because if they were not coordinated, they would have been overtaken fairly easily because Islam was very coordinated. Geographic. We'll talk about this more later in future weeks. Islam took over most of the Eastern Church. They allowed people to still practice Christianity. To this day, the Archbishop of Constantinople, which is now called Istanbul, but Christians still call it Constantinople, is allowed to practice and stay there. If you don't mess with them, they will generally leave you alone. You just won't have the same level of rights. This is not universal, but historically, taking the broad picture, most of the time this was the case. If you speak with a Muslim and point out, hey, you're a militaristic religion, they will instantly respond, when we took over Spain, we let the Christians stay Christians. When the Christians reconquered Spain, you killed us or kicked us out. Be prepared for that. Every Muslim will respond with that when you mention the militaristic aspect of their faith. How do you counter that? We made mistakes. We made mistakes. The Christians messed up. You study enough church history, you don't have a beautiful view of the church in history. The Christian church made a lot of mistakes over the centuries. Okay, this last one, more my area. I'm a history thought person. Scholarly impacts on Christianity. First, scientific advances. The Muslim world made Europe look really, really bad for many centuries. Most scientific advances that were made between 600 and 1200 were made in the Islamic world. Christians were useless scientifically. And in fact, the advances we started making in the 13th century were because we started picking up stuff from them. Our mathematical system is theirs. We used to use Roman numerals. Try doing advanced mathematics using Roman numerals. They really did have significant advances scientifically. Philosophical preservation. You might remember when the Vandals, Huns, Visigoths came in, they burned a lot of the libraries. The libraries that remained were in the Eastern Christianity. And when the Muslims took over, instead of burning the libraries, what they did was they started copying everything down. They rediscovered Aristotle. Aristotle was forgotten for five centuries. No, seven centuries. Maybe six. We'll go with six centuries. They rediscovered Aristotle and really built a lot of their theological foundation around Aristotle. They sort of made Aristotle a monotheist and then said, okay, we've made him a monotheist even though he wasn't. Let's see what else we can get. Which leads to our theological influences. In a few weeks, or quite a few weeks, we'll be talking about Scholasticism. Scholasticism is largely borrowed from Islam. The methodology scholastics use, and that is a big focus in scholasticism, are borrowed from Sunni methodology. Actually, taken straight out of Sunni methodology. Most of the Christianization of Aristotle was taken straight out of the Islamization of Aristotle. If you study Islamic philosophy, you don't find that much new in Aquinas. Most of it had been said already. Now, what is the influence of Scholasticism in the Christian church? That became the official position of the Roman Catholic Church. That was the official philosophy, and it still to this day is the official philosophy. So in many respects, the official philosophy of the Roman Church is from Islam. Okay, that's all I have, I think. Yes. So, questions? Max?
Jerusalem, third holiest site. What is the...
Yeah, Jerusalem is the third holiest site. In the very, very early years, Jerusalem was the first holiest site. Then it got demoted to the third. First is Mecca, second is Medina. And then if you're Shia, you have another list.
Why is Jerusalem?
Why is Jerusalem? Respect for Jesus and Abraham and Moses. What?
The rock of the...
No. Predates that.
Okay.
Yeah, they built that later, after it was already established as a holy city. It was a holy city starting year one.
I know it's a little off the subject, but what is the rock? Is
that a... Dome of the Rock. That's a Muslim... Yeah, it's built in the ground of the temple.
I know, but what is the rock? Dome of the Rock.
Dome of the Rock. Yeah, the temple was built on a hill. That's it.
Oh, that's the rock. Oh, I thought, okay. Was something different. Okay.
Any final questions? We covered a whole lot today. Okay, let's close with a word of prayer. Dear Heavenly Father, thank you that we can call you Father and you have sent your Son to form a personal relationship with us. Thank you for giving us an opportunity to study these historical developments so that we can learn from history, not make the same mistakes, and also learn what we did right. Help us understand these things that we talked about today in our witnessing to Muslims. Be with us in service today. Thank you for all that you've done for us. In your name we pray. Amen.